Lecture 6. Xerxes Prepares for War.
Welcome back. After that amazing victory at Marathon, the Athenians did something to honor those 192 fallen soldiers that they had never done before and that they would never do again. They allowed them to be buried on the field of battle itself, where they had won their great victory. Customarily in Athens, if you fell fighting for your city, you were either given back to your family, now as incinerated ashes in an urn following a cremation, and your family would place your remains in the little family burying plot outside the walls of the city. Or if you were considered to have been a great benefactor of the state, you would be buried on the sacred way that ran from the city gates out to the grove of olive trees called the Academy. But in this case, we know what they did. And we know that because the great mound, the Soros, that the Athenians created at Marathon for their honored dead, still survives and was excavated in the 1890s by archaeologists. What the archaeologists found was that the Athenians had gone out to the battlefield and first dug a trench about 30 feet long and 3 feet wide. And into that trench, they had placed the burned bodies of sacrificial animals, offerings to the gods and heroes who had assured this victory. There had been a shrine nearby where the Athenians were encamped at Marathon to their hero Heracles. He probably was represented in the sacrifices. There was another shrine nearby to their old hero Theseus, the slayer of the Minotaur, the liberator of the Athenians from Cretan domination. He would have been represented. And of course, their own goddess Athena, who was the patron goddess of their city, and gods like Poseidon, who was very dear to the Athenians. All of these gods were probably honored in that trench at Marathon. Miltiades himself had a cult of the goddess Artemis, and he had promised her a lot of goats, so they may also have been sacrificed among those burned animal bones that they found in the narrow trench. But above that trench was an enormous rectangle, 85 feet long, 30 feet wide, filled with the cremated remains, bones, and ashes of those 192 men, and of a special kind of Athenian vase which was offered in graves. It's called a lekythos, and it had other purposes too. It would have unguents or perfumes in it. But it was sometimes placed on tombs, and there was a tradition that you would go out and shed a tear into the vase and replace it on the tomb to let the dead soul of the person there below know you were still thinking of them, still grieving for them. So among the remains were these lekythoi, these little upright jugs, and also remains of other vases, some of them dating right to the time of the Persian War, sometimes older ones. Apparently there were so many dead they had to ransack other cemeteries to get older vases for the occasion. Also one big urn with the cremated remains of a single individual. We think that was perhaps one of the 10 generals. Each tribe was headed by a general. The Athenians call them a strategos, or multiple strategoi, who are the leaders of the tribal regiments and together lead the army of Athens. One of them probably was killed. Hoplite warfare had its generals on the front rank, and they were a subject to a very short life expectancy if battles were at all frequent. So with this monument, this Soros at Marathon, the Athenians marked forever the site of this amazing victory. Meanwhile, Darius received word of the disaster. The fleet returned to the coast of Asia Minor. The messengers set out from Sardis on their horses, one after the other, carrying the word back to Susa. And Darius decided he would try again. But before he could assemble another invasion force, he died. He was buried not up at Pasargadae with Cyrus, but at a new place, which was to become the sort of Valley of the Kings of the great kings of Persia, Naqsh-e-Rustam. And we still can see Darius' tomb today, like that carving at Behistun Rock, a sort of Mount Rushmore effect carved into the living cliff, lots of figures, inscriptions, and his epitaph. And it's so interesting to me that he was most proud of being a warrior, a man who fought his own battles. He says, "I was a good spearman, on foot and on horseback. I was good with the bow and arrow, on foot and on horseback." It will be a long time before we encounter another Persian king who is fighting in the front ranks of his army as they confront their enemies. Darius passed the grudge against the Greeks and the mission to punish Athens as an inheritance onto his son Xerxes. Xerxes is one of the first Persian kings to grow up entirely wrapped during his childhood in the enormously elaborate, civilized, and intricate ceremonials of the court, the ceremonial procedures of the court at Susa, and to grow up in a world dominated by the harem, by the women, by his own mother, Darius's widow Atossa, who remains a major figure in his reign. He is a great king used to palaces, to ceremonies and receptions, to administration and diplomacy, much more than he is to actual fighting. And this is going to put a mark on his reign and make it ironic that it was into his hands that this mission to conquer the Greeks was ultimately entrusted. Xerxes, however, did decide, partly because his father would have wanted it, I'm sure, partly because that Persian noble Mardonius, that kinsman of the royal house, who had led the invasion around the northern end of the Aegean after the Battle of Lade, at the time when Darius lost his fleet to the big storm off Mount Athos, Mardonius was still at court. Mardonius was still pressuring the great king to invade Greece, to punish those Greeks, to set up a satrapy, make him, Mardonius, the ruler of it. And Xerxes finally agreed. He was delayed, like Darius, by other business. The Persians, by this time, unlike Cyrus, did not rush into things. The energy had settled into a much more monumental sort of movement. And in order to conquer Greece, Xerxes relied not on lightning-like attacks, as his predecessor Cyrus had done, or on marshaling these great armies and getting these allies together and venturing into unknown territory. He was going to rely on a war of shock and awe, with amazing engineering feats that would show the power of the Persians over nature so that the Greeks would, he hoped, simply surrender. And just to back that up, Xerxes had decided to assemble the largest army and the largest navy the world had ever seen to conquer Greece. Surely, in this way, he could guarantee his own safety, the safety of the Persians themselves and of his realm, and of the God-assured success of his mission. 3 years before he actually planned to attack, we're now in the year 483 BC, Xerxes set his engineers to two great tasks. One was to cut a canal through the neck of the Mount Athos Peninsula so that his fleet, unlike his father's, could row through the canal ship by ship, get to the other side, and enter Greek waters without ever having to circumnavigate that very dangerous cape where his father's fleet had come to grief. The other great task was to bridge the Hellespont so that his army could walk or march across from Asia into Europe. These were not strictly necessary for the invasion effort, but they sure carried a message. The great king can do anything he wishes. If he wants to have his ships sail or row through dry land, they will do so. If he wants his army to walk on water, it shall be done. And meanwhile, while these were in progress, these two great engineering feats that we will look at in detail in just a moment, Xerxes was gathering that enormous army and fleet. Let's look first at the Mount Athos Canal. He put a cousin of his, the tallest Persian known, way over 6 feet, a great giant of a man with a huge voice, Xerxes put this man, Artaxerxes, in charge of the digging of the Mount Athos Canal. The chief geniuses behind it all seem to have been the Phoenicians, who had created various works around their own harbors. They were transported, along with lots and lots of workmen, up into this inhospitable area. There weren't markets and cities close by, so they had to ship the men in relays off to a place where they could have some R&R and get well fed, and then they'd bring them back to the isolated little peninsula for the canal digging. The challenge was enormous. They had to dig a canal about a mile and a quarter long through the neck of a peninsula that rose from the level of the sea at the beach on either side to a height of almost 50 feet in the middle. And they had to do this in 3 years, and they had to have it big enough so that two triremes, which each ship was about 20 feet wide, and with their oars extended, they were taking up about 40 feet of space. So you're talking 80 to 100 feet of space, so that they could pass each other or row side by side through this canal from the sea toward Asia into the sea on the European side. Well, Artakeus set his workmen to it. What he did was he'd gotten the usual Persian work levy, a group of workmen recruited from many different satrapies within the Persian Empire. So you get these polyglot or many-languaged work teams, just as the Persian armies tend to be many-languaged. And this can be kind of like the Tower of Babel situation, where people don't understand each other very well. Certainly the Phoenicians failed to convey to the others the right way to do it. The Phoenicians were given the central section where the land rose highest. They knew that they had to dig it very wide if it was going to be the proper depth at the bottom. So they started wide, they cut it down through the soil, sloping in toward the middle, and at the bottom it was the proper width for the water to be let in and the triremes, those great galleys, to be rowed through. The other nations, with their own segment, they weren't so smart. They dug it to the prescribed width at the top and went straight down. And of course, the sides fell in and they had to do the whole thing all over again. So the Persian overseers were very disgusted with them. The job stretched out for a long time. It wasn't until the actual year of the invasion that they were finally getting around to putting the breakwaters at either end that would keep the sea from bringing sand immediately into the canal and filling it up, and the watchtowers on the end of each breakwater. Those are still out there somewhere under the sea. We went up during our Mount Athos expedition to see if we couldn't find the remains of the Persian breakwaters. No luck, but I'm sure they're down there. But we did have a chance, since we were there, to walk the line of Xerxes' famous canal. Now, it was doubted even in antiquity by some historians that Xerxes had really managed to have his men cut a canal through that neck of Mount Athos. It had only been used once, after all, and never heard of again, and the Persians were used to boasting about their achievements, so people doubted it. That doubt grew stronger and stronger as the centuries went by, until there were many scholars in the 20th century who said flat out, this is just a legend. This is something the Persians said they did, but it doesn't make sense that they really could have. Well, those doubts were put to rest by a British and Greek geological team who, with some fancy geophysical seismic survey techniques, went up to Mount Athos, found the narrowest neck of this isthmus that connected Mount Athos itself to the mainland, and took their sensing tools over that hump of land and found that there was buried under the modern surface the remains of a vast cutting, 80 to 100 feet wide at its top, tapering to the bottom and getting down below sea level, exactly as Herodotus had said that the canal really was. And they found that original ideas that, it would have run into great masses of bedrock and they couldn't have dug through it, that was wrong. The canal builders had in fact chosen a path so that they only had to work with compacted sand, clay, and gravel. And so there was obviously a good deal of advanced study and coring of those pieces of terrain that they were going to dig the canal through to make sure that the thing would be practical. So we know that it happened. The remains of it are there, buried under the ground. The most of it that I saw was a little dip in the ground near one end with some cattle lapping fresh rainwater out of a puddle that had formed. That was all that I saw of Xerxes' great canal. But the ability of modern geophysics to look under the surface assures us it is still there. Now, even more spectacular to the Greeks than the canal was the bridging of the Hellespont. The Hellespont is that mile-wide, slightly twisting channel of water that comes from the Sea of Marmara down to the Aegean. It's part of a complex of waterways that drain the waters of the Black Sea out into the main oceans of the world. The Black Sea is, of course, filled up with the waters from Russia and the surrounding territories through rivers like the Don and the Dnieper. The Danube flows into the Black Sea. All that fresh water gets out through the Bosphorus, a little channel up near Byzantium or modern Istanbul, then gets into a sort of like a valve with a heart in the middle of it, a large inland sea called the Sea of Marmara, so-called because of the marble that's found on its islands, and then out through a second narrow channel, the Hellespont, and so into the Aegean. Xerxes did not want to have his men ferried across the Hellespont. It's not entirely clear why, but partly it must have been that idea of showing the Greeks, I can do anything. Surrender while you have the chance. I am a man who can cast bridges across arms of the sea. His engineers came up with a wonderful way to bridge the Hellespont. In a way, it was a kind of a suspension bridge, but the basis was not pilings set down into the sea floor. The basis was boats, warships used as floating supports, pontoons, on which the roadway would be set. So Xerxes, wanting in fact not one but two bridges, so that the main army could cross on one and all of the pack animals and supplies and baggage could cross on the other, he gave the engineers permission to requisition more than 600 hulls of triremes and the smaller galleys called pentacontors, the 50-oared galleys, as opposed to the triremes, which had 170 oars at three different levels. These ships were brought to the Hellespont. Each one of those ships had anchors on long cables. Their crews would row them out into the stream, and the anchors would be thrown over from stern and from bow, and the ships were then anchored facing into the oncoming water. The water rushed around them, they were held in their places, and eventually a line of ships was created, more than 300 in one, more than 300 in the other, from the Asiatic shore across to the European shore. These anchored ships were to be the basis for Xerxes' bridge. Once they were in place, the engineers brought gigantic cables. Many of these cables had been plated in Egypt out of papyrus. Some were made of esparto grass, but they were brought from Xerxes' empire and then attached to gigantic posts that were set on the coast facing out toward the line of ships. Tied to those posts, I believe there were winches so that they could be tightened, and then the cables were laid across the lines of ships, across their decks, from ship to ship to ship, and attached to the ships. That's the sort of suspension part. The ships held up these long suspended cables, and then on top of the cables, a roadway was built. Brushwood was laid down. Earth was put down on top of the brushwood to give firm footing for the animals that were going to go across. And finally, wicker screens were erected on either side, upstream and downstream, so that the horses and the other pack animals wouldn't see the water, the rushing water that they were passing over, panic and bolt off the bridge. In a few places, gaps were left in the long line of ships that ran from shore to shore so that merchant shipping and warships could get up and down through those gaps. So it was an amazingly sophisticated piece of engineering. The engineer who was in charge of the first thing put up a little plaque. He was a Greek from Ionia, taking credit for having bridged the Hellespont. Maybe he shouldn't have been so boastful. Shortly before Xerxes was actually planning to have his troops walk across, a huge storm blew down the Hellespont, tore up the cables, and the bridges, which had taken so long to build, were swept away. So in record time, the original engineering team having been beheaded, a new set were found to do the job again, get the bridge put up, and be ready for Xerxes and his grand army to cross. There are stories that the Greeks like to tell. They have very ambivalent feelings, not just about the Persians, but about Xerxes himself. I guess this is the moment to talk about the Greek double image of these Persians. On the one hand, they have tremendous respect and admiration for the Persians. The Persians occupy that elite little circle that the Spartans are in of warrior people whose ideals are pure. The Greeks may not have understood the concept of Ahura Mazda and the battle of light and darkness, but there was something about the purity of the Persian purpose in their wars, the idea that it was a war of right and justice and light against darkness and chaos. That came across. It also came across to them, the Greeks had a great admiration for success. The Persians were so successful as administrators, as builders, and so on. And they lived in this lifestyle of great achievement and great refinement. Beautiful civilization, palaces, great feasts. All of this was on the good side. But the Greeks still classed them as barbaroi, barbarians. I mentioned that word before. It means to a Greek, on the one hand, simply someone who doesn't speak Greek. What do they speak instead? Bar, 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 bar. We can't really put a name to it. It's just a non-Greek language and therefore not worth classifying. By the way, the shift from R to L, which is common in all languages of the world, means that that word, bar, 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 is the same as our blah, blah, blah. It's the way of expressing that someone talks in a way you can't understand. They're not real words. You'll sometimes read that barbarian was not originally to the Greeks a derogatory term. Don't you believe it? The attitude that people who don't talk Greek are just making noise has its own derogatory insult built right into it. In time, the Persians and their cousins, the Medes, became the barbarian. And if you see a Greek monument that says, these arms were taken from the barbarian, never doubt that is the Persians. So it is a double image, and one thing that increased the barbarian side of it, the not proper Greek side of it, was exactly what Xerxes had done in expending all this money, all this effort, all this manpower on bridging the Hellespont and cutting that canal through Athos. He was showing something that the Greeks knew and despised called hubris. Hubris is violent arrogance. And Xerxes was showing violent arrogance against nature in yoking two continents together with his cables of papyrus suspended on his bridge of ships. He was showing hubris and arrogance and violence against nature in cutting through what the gods had meant to be dry land so that his ships could easily pass. He even, according to Herodotus, just to show the peak of his mad hubris, he sent some of his men out into the Hellespont with whips to beat the water for having been so unruly as to break up great King Xerxes' first bridge. So in this way, the Greeks saw the arrival of the Persians both with fear and yet, in a strange way, with scorn. That these are people behaving unnaturally, and it is inevitable that the gods will be on our side and not on theirs. We've already encountered the great storm that happened to Darius's fleet. The Greeks put a theological spin on such natural disasters. The Delphic oracle had told the Greeks, or was going to tell them, pray to the winds. And the Greeks believed that the winds were in fact fighting for them as forces of the nature that the Persians had violated. And Xerxes too will find his fleet on a couple of occasions struck by violent storms, to which the Greeks gave all the credit to the gods for punishing this madman and his hubristic ambition. Now, Xerxes, to cap off all the rest of the preparations, decided to assemble this great army. People have doubted that there were really 1.7 million who were marching with him, and that's, I think, just the combatants. Herodotus says the full force was 4 million. Some German logistical scholars have studied the terrain that this grand army would have had to pass through and say, there's not enough water. You can't support that many people living off the land. Well, that's a strong argument, but not 100% strong. One of the things that Xerxes had his quartermasters do was establish supply depots all along the path of advance, years in advance, with imperishable foods heaped up and stockpiled ready for the army to come. And we know that the Persians did that with water also. We have Herodotus' statement that in Egypt, all of the wine jars that were imported from Greece with wine into Egypt during the Persian reign were emptied of their wine and sent out in the desert to Persian forts filled with water so that you could stockpile water for troops in areas where nature did not supply. So we're not yet at a point where we can definitely say exactly how many people the great king could have brought with him. But we do know it was the biggest army ever put together, that he brought together troops from every part of his empire, all the way from the Indus River Valley beyond the Khyber Pass, from Arabia, from the steppes of Russia. The Phoenicians, the Egyptians, they were all summoned to come to Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire, in the late spring of the year we call 481 BC, 2 years after the work had begun on the canal, and march with the great king to conquer Greece. And Herodotus gives wonderful descriptions of all of the different clothing, all of the different uniforms, the armor and the weaponry and the customs of all these different people brought together in this gigantic host, this nation on the move. Xerxes, of course, had no intention of hurrying. He wanted the slowness of his approach to give time for the Greeks to panic, to divide and separate as the Ionians had done in the battle at Lade, and ultimately, because they would be divided, be easy to conquer. He himself traveled slowly. He had his chariot. He had his women with him in their covered carts, and they couldn't move faster than the pace of the Magi, the holy men of the Zoroastrian religion, who were carrying the portable altars with the fire on them, walking along with the army to, as they hoped, a victory assured by Ahura Mazda. Now, as the army left Susa in April of 481, there was an eclipse of the sun. The Persians, like other people, set great store by this kind of celestial phenomenon, and there were among the Persian troops, as I said, magi, who could interpret all these star signs and sky signs. Xerxes immediately asked them, what does it mean that there should be an eclipse of the sun? And these experts on astronomy knew what caused the eclipse. They knew that it was the disk of the moon passing over the sun. And they said, great king, the sun represents the Greeks, just as the moon represents the Persians. Your force is being seen to blot out the light of the Greek world. Your victory is guaranteed. Well, this was exactly what Xerxes wanted to hear. I'm sure he would have been very embarrassed if they'd said the other way around. What's he going to do, disband the largest army the world has ever seen? So he set off on the march. We need to remember that one of his reasons for being on the march with all these troops from all over the empire is to strip the empire of local armies, militias, that could rise up against him while he's away with the main force of Persians attacking Greece. So there was military method to what the Greeks saw as madness. On the way to Sardis, he passed a sycamore tree. We're going to end here. We will pick up the king's approach to the sea next time. But this is such a beautiful story in Herodotus, and it reminds us of that quality of the Persian kings as creators of the parks, the paradises, the gardener kings. There was a tree called a plane tree, a sycamore, a cousin of the American sycamore tree, that grew to great height, and its branches were enormous, and it was there by the road from Susa to Sardis, by the great road. And the king saw it, and it was the most beautiful tree he had ever seen. And true to that strain of the Persian kings, that they were the gardener kings, he had the army stop so that he could have the tree decked with ornaments and could worship it as this great force of nature placed in his path, to be honored as if it were something divine. If you have ever heard the beautiful piece of music by George Frideric Handel that's called the Largo, it is from an opera called Xerxes, and it opens with this scene of the young king glorying in the beauty of this lovely tree, singing that immortal melody, and capturing in the 18th century of our era, in that Baroque stage work, the beautiful side, the nature-loving side of these Persian kings, a world which was about to be violated and broken by this extraordinary invasion of Greece and all of the bloodshed, all of the battles, and all of the disasters that lay ahead.